Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, it's all about crazy cinematic visions and whether or not they work, and there's a lot to talk about. So let's get on with the show. My name's Aaron Peterson. Joining me today, my fellow host, Troy Heinrichs.
I'm the only one standing this week.
Yes, John Davenport won't be here. He is dealing with hurricane repercussions, obviously. He's okay. His home's okay. All of those things. So he's safe and good. But he still has a lot to deal with. Amanda is dealing with a very personal matter. And so joining us in the third chair is actually one of the creators of The Hollywood Outsider, in a way, Rod Rowalt.
Hey, how you doing?
So exciting.
Wow. I feel like I'm among greatness.
Yeah.
You should feel that way, because without me, Aaron would have never gotten his original website and product off the ground.
That is true. 100%. Rob is, he is an IT extraordinaire in many respects, and he's the one that helped me build the original website way back in the day, and then The Hollywood Outsider itself, as well as lots of other random endeavors I've had over the years. The original one was called what? Let's talk about movies, right?
Let's talk about movies.
And I think somebody has that on Facebook now, and they're doing very well. So good for them, jackasses.
My question is are you still getting your royalties? Is that like in one piece of candy corn at a time? Like, what did it pay you from 10 years ago, 12 years ago?
Yeah, I was a fool and signed no paperwork, so I get no royalties.
Oh. He gets beer. He's a beer connoisseur. In fact, he has a podcast, if you want to mention it real quick.
Yeah, sure. It's called Rob from the Internet Talks About Beer. It's on a slight hiatus right now. We've got three seasons that were done, and I'm in the midst of rejiggering the way it's going to be. So I'm working on getting some new guests, and I'm working on my format, because I think it was a little too long the last time. A lot of people kind of tune out when it comes to beer after about 10 or 15 minutes. So, ooh, you know.
You're going to shorten it, like make 10 or 15 minute episodes?
I'm gonna try and keep it to about 20 minutes, 30 minutes tops. Most of mine went 45 minutes to an hour, and I think that's just too much old white guy talking about beer.
I think what you need to do is incorporate more beer drinking during the actual podcast, and I think the longer it goes, it's going to be far more entertaining.
Yeah, some of the most entertaining ones are the ones where we're drinking like the double-digit ABV beers, because by the time we get through two beers on the show, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm saying. That's what I want to listen to. I just start at 30 minutes in.
I'm waiting for the marathon call-in to raise money for some service where they're doing the power hour, 1 ounce of beer every minute.
That's funny. In case you haven't heard Rob before, he was on several Remake This Movie Right episodes as well. I think, you weren't on Dark Tower, but you did, you were very upset. You were hurt that you didn't get to come into the Stephen King episode.
Right? I was shocked and dismayed.
It was very last minute. It was very last minute.
Because much like you guys, I have lots of opinions about Stephen King and his works and his title as King of Horror. Unlike Troy, I am a connoisseur of all things Stephen King. I love all the horror. I love all the weird fiction. Now, Dark Tower is the Dark Tower series is my favorite of his. As are the other ones, like 11/22/63. The time travel is great, so good. All that. So but good. I'm also a fan of biting dogs, biting cars, and biting people. So,
oh, be careful. We do that a lot in America these days, is what I'm hearing. So be careful with that. Sorry. Too close to it's election season. I got to be careful. You know, you don't want to make
it. Careful.
Any,
that's right.
Yeah. Oof. I don't want to lose people. Vote for whoever you want. I ain't got time for that. Just vote. Yeah. There you go. Just vote. Pick your side. Now, what we're doing this episode is we might talk about other stuff after we get through with our From the Outside In topic, but I want to start there. Kind of like what we did last week, where we started with Stephen King because we knew it was going to be a longer topic and we wanted to just dive into it. And so, very similar this week, right? So crazy cinematic visions. That's what we want to talk about. And how do I explain that is Megalopolis came out and was helmed by Apocalypse Now and Godfather director Francis Ford Coppola. He's accredited as one of the greatest directors of all time, right? Joker 2 was directed by Joker and Hangover director Todd Phillips, and both of those movies hit theaters in back-to-back weeks, and they flopped spectacularly.
Hard.
Yeah, it was very, very... There's a lot of money that is just washed away in both of those films. And then Terrifier 3 comes out, shows up, and somehow delivers a huge number one movie in the country, overtakes both of these films very, very easily. Very easily. It's relentlessly gory. It's completely unrated, which is a very rare, if unheralded accomplishment to open at number one with a completely unrated film. And it's an unflinching vision. And what I mean, it's very similar. I know people don't want to give it the same kind of credit, right? Joker 2. Come on. That's to a huge franchise and character. And Megalopolis. This is a seasoned director, you know, awards worthy director on all fronts. I get it. And, you know, you're trying to compare them to Damien Leone, who made Terrifier. And what I'll say to that is he had a film that he made, the first Terrifier, was kind of a character from two or three other films that were anthologies. And he made that one film very, very cheaply, hardly anything, made very little money. And then in 2021 or whenever it was that they created the Terrifier 2, that was all crowdfunded. So he refused to give up his vision because after the crowdfunding, that movie was very successful and studios would approach him and say, yeah, we'll give you X number of dollars if you give us the rights to that character because they're going to go and make their R-rated version. And he said, no, I want to stick to whatever batshit insanity I got going on here and make my movies my way. And now it's led to crazy success. And I would say that's also a crazy cinematic vision because how many people would give up guaranteed success for the opportunity to do something that no one else has really done, at least in a long time, created a horror icon.
Oh, for sure. I mean, from my perspective, what he's done is one, he's bringing back, he's heralding back to, an earlier time in horror, like, the Terrifier movies, you know, I've seen the first two. I haven't seen the third one yet, obviously, cause it's not out yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's out now. Number one.
Well, it's not out for me yet. I won't go to the theaters to see it. And I don't know that it's actually playing in any theaters around me because Canada, you know, small market.
You son of a bitch.
He what he said. You invite him on the show and he says, I'm not going to go to theaters.
He'll still watch them. He just doesn't want to go to the theater. He's not a theater guy. Not everybody's a theater guy. I understand there are people like him that exist and I just don't understand them. But
right. Well, he's your friend. I just want to point this out.
I go to theaters. It's just that I don't go unless it's like something I'm really, really excited about. Like I went and saw Wolverine and Deadpool three times in the theaters, paid good money every time because I go to the VIP theater where there's no kids allowed and they serve you booze and food in your seat, you know.
Oh, that's why he's here. He's an Arjun fan.
I just love how nobody, by the way, side tangent,
sidebar,
I love how nobody can ever say that name right. He just said Wolverine and Deadpool. Amanda always says Deadpool versus Wolverine. It's like nobody can ever say the title,
Aaron,
right.
That's the joke.
That's funny.
I just call it Deadpool's 99 problems.
Yeah, right. And Wolverine ain't one.
All right. So back to you. So your point on Terrifier.
Right. So, I mean, he's not only got a vision. I mean, this guy's got chutzpah. He's he knows what he wants to do with this character that he is, you know, for a better term, lovingly brought into the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, he doesn't want to compromise. And in today's world of yes men, when it comes to Hollywood and remake of this and remake of that, you know, he's sticking up for himself and he's you know, he's just got conviction, which is one of those things that seems like it doesn't exist that much anymore in Hollywood because everybody seems to bend towards the trend and he's not bending towards the trend. He's forging his own path and he's doing quite well. I mean, what the movie number three was made for what? $2 million.
Yeah.
Article on it today, and I was like, I was dumbfounded by just how little he spent on these movies. Because like the first one, for what it was great. I loved it. I mean, it's obviously it's not AAA title, you know, special effects and all
it's
that.
Grindhouse
stuff.
Horror is what.
Yeah,
it is.
It's grindhouse horror, exactly. But you know what it is great. At least you know from my perspective, getting back to the nitty gritty of movie making.
Yeah. And just to your point, the last one was made for 200 and some thousand. And I think it made 15 million in the box office. And then this one was made for 2 million marketed with marketing and everything else. It was less than 5 million total, all told. and it opened to 18 million. So it would probably make around 50 when it's all said and done. That's phenomenal. That's phenomenal. And that's no studio involvement, and it's unrated. People don't understand, like, that to me is the impressive part. Unrated movies do not open at number one because they rarely ever get the theaters for it. The last one got such a low theater count. Like, it built theaters as it went because people wanted to see it more. But when it first opened, it was very, very minor in terms of the theater count. Like, this has been a very kind of grassroots development, and that's pretty exciting. Meanwhile, Megalopolis, huge flop. Joker 2, huge flop. And Troy, real quick, I guess, but you saw Joker 2, and I'm not saying the actual folie à deux.
I don't know. It's French.
I think folly is the right word.
Folie à deux. There we go. Okay. Joker 2 works great. So, and it won't be a trilogy. I can tell you that right now. It has flopped just horribly. Is it as bad as people say? And I mean, by that, most people?
Yeah, I mean, you're implying that I actually saw the movie because I think I slept through 2 hours of it because it was that boring.
Ouch.
It's pretty bad.
Okay.
Let's just put it that way. Well, the interesting thing about Joker 2 is this. I think what Todd was trying to do was that he didn't want to make this movie and the studios forced him to make the movie. And what he did was actually arrange the movie in a certain way in order to, I guess, poke fun at the studio in a way. Because the characters in the movie, I think, represent certain things. There's a really great TikTok about this that explains it. But basically, I'm not going to do it justice, but it was that the police in the jail are representative of, like, the producers. Harley Quinn is technically the studio. And then Todd is representative of the Joker himself, right, in Phoenix. And it's basically like an allegory of Todd saying, you know, look, like, I want to make this movie the way I want to make this movie about Arthur. And the studio was coming in saying, no, 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 we're going to beat you down until you actually make the Joker. And Harley Quinn is only in love with the Joker, not Arthur. So I think that from that perspective, it's actually really interesting from an artistic standpoint of what he was trying to do. But at the same time, it killed what was an amazing first movie about mental illness and everything that brought forward. And then it was like, why did it have to be a musical? Why did it not focus on anything outside of the prison and the courtroom? I don't want to see the Joker sit in a courtroom for an hour. It was terrible. When he tried to be the Joker and represent himself, it wasn't funny. It was just, it was bad all around.
Just, well, I for one, thank you for taking one for the team.
I love, Joaquin was so good.
Oh, the first one, I absolutely loved it. I believe my exact words were, it was a fantastic study into the slow descent of madness of man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly right.
That's fair.
That's exactly right. And so now we're at this point where other people are jumping on board, which is like, and not to get political, but it's like, what perfect timing to say, here's all of these sheeples that are basically out there that are following this person who are going to cause chaos on Gotham if they follow the Joker instead of coming to some kind of common decency. Like, it's like the marketing tie-in for the election year is just brilliant strategy, and yet that is not what happened. We just saw this guy devolve into a, my mom never loved me, blah, blah, blah. Ooh, look, there's a girl that likes me. For me, I think she's pretty and I want to do things for her, but she only wants to see the bad side of me. She doesn't want to see the good side of me.
Oh, she likes bad boys. I get it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like, this is the most snooze fest courtroom rom-com that I've ever watched in my entire life.
So bringing that back to topic, with those two, well, taking out Terrifier, because that's actually been a success. But you look at Megalopolis, right? And you have Francis Ford Coppola put $120 million of his own money in there. It's 15 is about what it's going to make, maybe 20.
Because he didn't learn from Costner, you don't do that?
that's called hubris.
Yeah, he needs some. And then you've got Joker 2, which feels like Todd Phillips just, you know, milking the studio for $200 million to... Because that's the budget on that one, $200 million on this movie, which is insane.
They wrote him the check. He didn't milk anybody. Yeah. They gave him the check.
I get it, man. But when you see, that's the same budget as Spider-Man No Way Home. Just to put it in perspective, like, you just saw Joker 2. Did you see $200 million worth of film?
There was one massive explosion. Otherwise, he's sitting in a prison cell, in a courtroom, or in a car.
Yeah, not great. So do you consider these, this is the question, do you consider these failures if they are the vision that these guys had? Todd Phillips swears this is his vision. This is what he wanted. And Francis Ford Coppola thinks that in 20 years, his movie is going to be a cult masterpiece. I think both of them are very wrong about their opinions, but who knows? Time will tell. What do you think that makes it a failure if the vision that they wanted was accomplished, even if people didn't like it?
That's a hard question to answer, because to them, it won't be a failure, because if it did strike true to the vision that they were looking for, then mm-hmm. they've accomplished what they were out to do. But from a general public standpoint, yeah, it's a complete failure.
Yeah. Like what is considered failure from whose point of view? I think that's really the big question.
Well, from fans' point of view, do we consider them like,
oh yeah, it's an utter failure.
Yeah.
It is a complete mockery of the first movie that Joker even like exists as a part two. And it literally is a part two. He's on trial for the murders that happen at the end of the first movie. So it is a direct continuation.
So it's a cash grab. That one's a cash grab.
From a studio perspective, absolutely.
Do you like when visionaries like this take these big swings though? Like at least they're trying to do something. Because this is the thing. Like people love to say this argument. Fans don't want remakes, retreads, and sequels, which we all know, according to box office, is just not true. It's just right. not true. Like, factually, there are more tickets sold for those things than anything else because IP, people go to what they know and they like, and da da da. So it's just something that people love to say. And then you have these visionaries that are trying to make something. Now, granted, by most accounts, didn't work, at least for two of the three films here. And we're going to talk about some other films here shortly. We're not just going to talk about these three. But is it... It doesn't bode well for people to try these things in the future. Kevin Costner's Horizon is another great example, right? You've got all that money sunk into that, and that's not going to go anywhere because nobody went and saw Horizon. So you have these visionaries that have these ideas for films that don't go anywhere, and all that's doing is saying, no, fans, I hate to break it to you, but they aren't working, and this isn't going to be something that you want or get.
Yeah, I see that. But I, for one, I'm all for these guys. Failure or not, I'm all for them going out and making these movies, because whether or not the movie is a commercial success, there's bound to be something in there that's going to inspire somebody who's going to be the next generation's whatever, you know,
I like that.
The next generation's writer, director, producer, whatever. They're going to see something in these movies because they are so, you know, tend to be so grandiose in their scope, in their scale, that there's bound to be something that's going to have, you know, going to ignite that flame in somebody and make them want to go into this business.
You know, I think Rob's onto something, because yeah, the movie's so bad. I could do that movie better. Let me go write my own script. Here's how I would have done that scene. Let me go storyboard that out and then start shooting it. And
that's
then
not exactly what I was saying, but I'll take it as a win.
That's what the internet does today, though. I mean, I could throw it up on YouTube and boom, I got a whole recut version of Joker Fall a Better.
Right, right.
That's
Fall a Better.
Fall a Better. All right. Well, now I want to move into, here's what I want to do is I want to talk about like specific movies where you had a director, writer, whatever, who were taking big swings with big, crazy cinematic visions for different reasons, and just kind of like get your feelings on, do you think they succeeded or failed in this, right? Just sure. to get your idea. So the first one, this is Tarantino. He's my favorite working director. Hitchcock is my favorite all time. He did two films, Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And both of those movies took big swings. I don't think it was as big a swing for the second one because he'd kind of already set the stage with the first movie, but yep. he retconned history in a major way from very large historical events.
Well, for people that might not have seen those movies, what is the historical event that they retconned?
Well, Inglourious Basterds, you know, Hitler dies in a completely different way, very different way. And Once Upon a Time in History changes what happened with the Manson murders. Which you can famously hear on Inspired by a True Story if you'd like to hear the whole true story. But
look at that shameless plug.
Yeah, you like that? Yeah.
That's why I set him up.
I didn't feel dirty at all. So those are big swings, I think, from a creative standpoint, because people, they think they know what's going to happen in many respects, and then it doesn't happen, and they have to either swallow it or don't. I think it's obvious both of those succeeded, But what did you guys think about retconning history?
I don't see it as retconning history so much as making fictionalized history. It's just like making a novel where you take, you know, based off of events and you take your own spin on it. There's plenty of historical novels that you know, they take characters and events from actual history and use artistic license to make their vision come true. And I think that's exactly what he did with both of these movies. Like, they were both, let me put it out there. I think both these movies are great. Mm-hmm. I loved Inglourious Basterds. I thought it was absolutely bat crap crazy. It was one of my favorite movies when it came out, just because it was a rather irreverent take on a very serious topic.
Yeah, very much.
So,
yeah, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I mean, it's a great character study in like how acting works for a good chunk of the movie, and you get to the end and you're just like, where is this going? And then that last 15 minutes is like just batshit crazy. You're like, what is happening right now? This is amazing. And you're just like the ending makes the movie. I mean, it absolutely does.
And it also kind of gave a happy ending to Sharon Tate, or happy memory for Sharon Tate for some people, you know.
Sure.
Her story is very tragic, and that left it, you know, what could have possibly happened if it wouldn't have went down that way. And I kind of like that.
What if scenario.
The what if scenario. Yeah, very much so.
And what if scenarios work all the time? I mean, like thinking Man in the High Castle.
Yeah,
Man in the High Castle is like the most like perfect way to like retcon history and explain what would have happened if the Nazis ended up winning World War II, and just trying to live through that experience watching that show. I mean, there's some really freaky stuff that happens in there, including the Japanese and Nazis fighting each other over what was left of America. I mean, it's interesting to see like one thing goes different, what would happen. Those types of things tell really great stories because people want to know the right answer to those questions.
Right. Same. Another one like that for me is For All Mankind.
Yeah.
You know,
For All Mankind is a great show.
It's another fantastic what if type scenario. And that was also, you could say it's retconning, but it's not. It's fictional history. It's alternative fiction history.
What's the retcon on that one? Is that the one where the Soviets are first?
Russia,
the moon?
Yeah, Russia goes first.
Russia and then it gets to space first. Yeah.
And then it becomes like since Russia got there first, what is America going to do? We're going to put women in space first.
Right.
And it becomes a focus on the women getting to space first.
Oh, do they get the vote?
Whether they go or not? No, they get a sign from mission director.
Yeah. Again, this and both the Man in the High Castle and For All Mankind both fall into that kind of vision type things, because they were taking chances turning these into shows, you know, making these shows, because they are not mainstream topics that you would typically turn into, you know, I guess award-winning style shows.
Mm-mm. which could rile up other cultures, because I think the latest season of For All Mankind like was going up against Korea, and so it's like, how do these countries today react as we're retconning the history of those things?
Right.
And are you going to get any backlash from Russia? Are you going to get any backlash from Korea? Like those are questions that I think are really interesting to say, like, do we have a responsibility as filmmakers and creators to maybe think about what we put out there before we actually might ruffle some feathers?
Oh, that's a good question. Nope. Put it out there. Let them panic.
That's
Let's
right.
get Idiocracy in full effect. So Psycho. This is another big one, right? Now, this could be seen as quite, I know it's hard to say it's visionary when it's basically just a carbon copy. It's a Xerox of a movie. But Gus Van Sant decided he's going to do a, in color, shot-for-shot remake of Psycho. The only thing he added was a scene where Norman creepily masturbates behind the door, and that was just completely unnecessary. And really, I don't want to get into that because it just pisses me off to really talk about it, because you ruined a classic, classic film. But I digress. What do you think about the idea? And I will say, this is something that failed so spectacularly, it's never been done again. Like, that's how much this didn't work, according to cinephiles, other studios and whatnot. Do you think this was an interesting idea at all? Or was this just a ridiculous money grab? Because I can see this one either way, and I still don't know which way I really want to think about it.
Honestly, for me, it's never a good idea to do. It's basically a shot for shot remake of anything. It's just like, if you're going to music, if you're going to redo a song, make it your own. If you're going to redo a movie, make it your own. Mm-hmm. Don't, you know, don't take what's already there and just say, hey, look, I did the same exact thing and expect people to go, ooh, ah, fantastic. Because, you know, I'm not going to go see that. It's not the thing. If someone says, hey, this is basically an exact copy of this other movie that you really liked, I'm like, well, why would I see it? I've already seen the movie then.
Yeah, you have to think about the four quadrants that you have to fit for your target audiences in order to actually make money at the theaters, and to do a movie where two of those quadrants have already seen the original. I mean, that's basically throwing out half your audience, because no one's going to go see the original. They're not going to go see the new one. I think the counter to that, though, is like Sleeping Beauty.
Disney remakes.
And Beauty and the Beast, the Disney remakes.
Like taking animated and going into live action. Well, I think that's a little different story, though, than taking a live action live and doing a shot for shot remake of it. I mean, that's
because now I'm super interested in seeing the cartoon anime version of Psycho. I think that would be really cool.
Me too. Yeah, me too. The same.
Beauty and the Beast was like pretty much a shot for shot remake, just live action.
It was. Yeah. It was very close. Yeah. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a very good point. The sad thing about the Psycho situation is I thought Vince Vaughn was great, actually, as Norman Bates.
He was.
Yeah, because he was playing the character a little different. He wasn't playing it the way Perkins played him. And I think Vaughn has a very disarming way about him, just like Perkins did, which if you didn't know the story, I think you could have bought the story more. But because so many people already know that story, I don't think there's any way that they could have made it terrifying again. Too many people have talked about it.
Not in the same way, at least.
No. Now, here's another cinematic vision, right? And when I say this, George Lucas, I think, is one of the greatest at cinematic visions. He created Star Wars. That's an entire world, a universe. I think he should be held to some kind of gold standard because of that. But he also made The Phantom Menace, and that just knocked him right off the shelf. So, but overall, the question I have is, his vision was, I'm going to show you how Darth Vader became. And I still, I mean, some people, you know, I think it really depends on what era you grew up in. If you were a kid at the time these came out, you probably loved these films. I know my kids loved these films. I don't get it, but I also grew up on the other ones, right? But I also look back on them and go, did we need that? You know, was that really... couldn't he have done so much more with that universe? You know, this is one of those where you Monday morning quarterback kind of to a degree. Like, did we need to see Darth Vader as a child? Was that necessary for the Yippie?
Not for me.
No, it didn't fill in any blanks for you. It wasn't,
you know, I have, by far and large, I have, found that most of the expanded Star Wars shows and movies that they have done have all been things that I was never concerned about to begin with. To make the experience wow for me, like it's a space opera that centers around one family for the most part. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to know the backstory of how Anakin, you know, became Darth Vader, or that he, you know, as a what, 9-year-old was in love with a 18-year-old or whatever it was.
Nobody ever talked about how creepy that was.
Yeah. Right? I mean, that was creepy stuff. You know, I didn't need to know that. I didn't need to know a lot of it. Was a lot of it cool? I mean, yeah. Sam Jackson as a Jedi. That was pretty damn cool.
Purple lightsaber. That was pretty bitching.
I have a purple lightsaber in this room.
I have a purple lightsaber.
Y'all a couple of mofos.
That's right. No snakes on this plane.
What's your wallet say?
I've gone back and forth about Phantom Menace. Like Jar Jar, no.
Jar Jar.
Gungans, no. Like take them completely out of the movie. But most of the movie is actually structured very much like a Star Wars film, right? You have the giant battle sequence with the droids at the end. You got the lightsaber duel, which was freaking fantastic. And you got the master, the Padawan. So it very much, you know, formulates exactly like A New Hope does, right? Where Qui-Gon dies so that Ewan McGregor has to step up as Obi-Wan. You know, just the same way that Obi-Wan dies so that Luke has to step up. So there's a lot of formulaic similarities with that movie. I think the challenge that we ran into was you had to have a child, because in order to become a Jedi, you need to be trained as a child. And so they had to make the statement of he's too old at this point in order to go through the training, but yet still be young enough to be considered. Because if you would have made him say like a teenager, well, then he's never going to be considered. So that whole storyline doesn't happen. So it's a lot of about Obi-Wan really saying, I believe in this person to be the savior. Now, why he's a savior in the Midichlorians and all of that garbage? Like, no, didn't need any of that stuff. But I do like the fact that, you know, everybody thinks that Luke was the one that was the person that brought balance to the Force at the end. But you remember, it's actually Anakin, who is now reconverted from the dark side back to the light side, that kills the Emperor, not Luke Skywalker. So it is a 6-episode story about Anakin Skywalker, and I think that's great. The problem was execution. The second movie is terrible.
And absolutely terrible. All the stereotypes that Luke has put in there for the different races really, really does not age well, really did not age well. And at the time, even, it was controversial. And and I found it. I'm one of the least offended people on the planet, and I found a lot of that offensive.
I mean, people talk about Force Awakens and how much it's just a carbon copy clone of A New Hope, just a planet instead of a Death Star and all this other stuff.
Yeah. It is. I mean,
so is Phantom Menace in a lot of ways. If you go back and watch it, there's a lot of similarities.
Sure, I can see that.
But I don't want to go back and watch it.
So that's what I would say. Would you guys call this a success or a failure? I'm not talking financially. I'm just talking overall as a fan. Do you consider that a success or a failure? Based on what he was going for.
I think it's a success because it sets up a bunch of other stuff that you could build off of. Now, I don't think a lot of stuff has been built off of it well, right? But there have been good hits. Like Rogue One, I think, is a really fantastic thing.
Rogue One was a great movie. I mean,
and then it wasn't one I needed. That down with Andor. Andor has been the best TV show out of all of them, I think.
I mean, it's no Book of Boba Fett, but
exactly.
It is far removed from Book of Boba Fett. Far removed.
What could be?
No, I think it was a success. I think it is still a success. I mean, it's proven its wherewithal. I mean, look, it started in 1977. Here we are in 2024, going into 2025 here soon, and they're still making Star Wars stuff.
Yeah. So I guess they've all been successful in some way.
Yeah, in their own right, they're all successful. I mean, some just not as successful as others. There hasn't been, I don't think there's been any Star Wars movie or show that's been a complete failure. I think
Boba Fett. I'd say Boba Fett was in there somewhere.
I saw The Acolyte, one season and done. That was
Book of Boba Fett was one season and done, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and it should have been one episode and done.
It really was Mandalorian two and a half.
Yeah, it was Mandalorian two and a half. It was.
Yeah. I love when people say, I love episodes 5 and 6 or whatever it was. I'm like, yeah, when The Mandalorian showed up. That's the only time that show was worth a damn.
But, I mean, they weren't complete failures. They still got eyeballs on it, and they're still a valid part of the overall universe that they've tried to, you know, create and scape. Yeah, they might not be for everybody, like The Acolyte. You know, a lot of people think that it went a little too far in some of the way it was pushing things. But, you know,
great concepts, poor execution.
Yeah, there's still an audience out there for it. I mean, I talked to a few people who I'm friends with who are big Star Wars nerds, and they were generally upset that it didn't at least get 2 seasons so they could try and redeem it. But, you know,
Star Wars fans are fickle.
Wrap it into Ahsoka, because really that's where it ties into. Let me think about it.
I got to cut in this conversation just a second because I want to tell you about a movie that is new today on digital called The Silent Hour. And it stars Joel Kinnaman as a detective guarding a deaf witness marked for death after seeing a gang murder. Trapped by the killers, they have to outsmart them to survive. Sounds exciting, sounds riveting, and is very good. Actually, check it out. Buy or rent The Silent Hour now. It's rated R from Republic Pictures. And again, it's on digital now. And if you want a chance to win a copy, I tell you what, send us an email to contests@thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's contests@thehollywoodoutsider.com with the subject line, shh, you know, in honor of the Silent Hour. And we will put your name into a drawing for one of 5 digital codes of the Silent Hour that we are giving away to all of you. Okay? So do that. contests@thehollywoodoutsider.com. The subject line is shh. Just give us your name and we'll get back to you if you happen to win. Now let's get back to the show. Moving on. So then we have Ron Howard, who tried to bring Dr. Seuss to life with How the Grinch Stole Christmas. That's another one we chose. I know that's a weird one to choose, but that's a really big leap in terms of something that's always been in a book form or animated form. And now you're going to bring it to live action. And it really does not look real ever. It always looks like puppets almost. But I feel like for a lot of people, that movie really clicked. And I'm sure a lot of that was Jim Carrey's performance and whatnot. Do you feel like that really brought the essence of Suits to life?
I don't know that it necessarily brought the essence of Suits to life any more than the original 37-minute animated brought it to life. What it did is I think it just reintroduced it to a whole different demographic of customers. And I think part of it was, you know, like you said, it didn't look real. It looked like it was supposed to be puppets. I think that was by design. I mean, it's not supposed to be real life. It's not supposed to be like, you know, hey, this is how it is. It's supposed to be this fantastic, you know, whimsical world of the Who's. And, you know, they're not supposed to look like, you know, you and I.
Yeah, except that it was the cats before the cats. I mean, the Who's did not look good in that movie. That was the problem.
I was not making a commentary on whether or not it was a successful look for the characters. I'm just saying it wasn't designed to look like real people.
You consider that one a success or failure? I consider that one a success because I know a lot of kids love that one. Amanda on the show, she loves that movie. She's talked about it many, many times. So I guess I'll call that one a success because a lot of kids grew up with it and they loved it.
I would say it was a success up until the point that Illumination came out with Dr. Seuss is the Grinch. Because Dr. Seuss is the Grinch goes back to the animated side and does make a whole different spin on the Grinch character and makes you kind of fall in love with the Grinch character because he's fun and lighthearted and he's doing things. And like, I'd much rather watch that version than the live action version. But when I didn't have that version from Illumination, I did kind of like the Jim Carrey version because it was different.
Yeah.
But now that the Illumination version is out, I'd go to the Illumination version every time and forget that Jim Carrey even existed on that one.
And I have to say that, I mean, overall, the whole Seussiverse type thing, if you want to give it a name, has been successful because, I mean, look, you had, whether you like them or not, you had the Cat in the Hat movies. You know, they were live action as well. And they did fairly well again with kids. I mean, they knew their target audience and that's what they went for. So I think overall the Grinch Stealing Christmas and the Seussiverse stuff has been successful.
All right. Now I've got a couple other crazy cinematic visions. I thought these were just fun ideas, but they're weird, right? So you had Junior, which is Ivan Reitman directing Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, where they get Arnold Schwarzenegger pregnant. And the idea is, you know, we're going to show what it's like for a man to go through what a woman goes through. And I mean, hit or miss comedy wise. I call that one a success because it's so ridiculous. It actually works.
I agree.
Like they're twins.
Yeah. Scenario. I mean, and just those two, the juxtaposition between Arnold and Danny DeVito is a win. No matter what the subject matter is going to be, just because the way they play off each other is just, It's something to behold.
I think it only works because twins worked, right? So it's like it's trying to follow up on that success. If twins doesn't happen, then this one doesn't happen. Because if this was by itself standalone, I think it probably would have flopped, to be honest.
Well, it's still got the same guys in it. It's the same movie. I mean, yeah, the movie did flop. I don't think the movie actually did very, very well, honestly.
But as far as vision goes, I think it works.
Yeah, it's a really creative and innovative idea, though. Like, it's interesting, I thought. then you've got Look Who's Talking, and I know it spawned a bunch of films, and obviously financially it was a big to do. But I thought this was a very creative idea, and this is like a crazy vision. Like someone pitched this: hey, we're gonna have family. We're gonna make a family movie. John Travolta and Kirstie Alley are in it, but they don't matter because we're gonna have Bruce Willis. And then the studios just like, it's kind of like that YouTube guy who just does all those studio pitch meetings or whatever. And here's what we're going to do. And then Bruce Willis shows up and somebody's like, oh, we got Bruce Willis in the movie? No, he's just talking. Wait, what? Yeah, he's the baby's voice. What the fuck is happening here? Like, that's how I figured that whole pitch is. And it's amazing to me. I think that is one of the most creative ideas in recent decades, personally. I don't know if you guys agree.
Yeah, and by the way, we're going to open up the movie as he's traveling a sperm down to the egg the entire time. It's like...
I just want to know how much cocaine was involved before this got pitched.
Oh, right? Man, so much. And then somebody had to go to Bruno and be like, hey, what do you think about a family movie? Oh, I'd love to do a family movie. You're going to voice a baby. What? I just did Die Hard, dick. Wait, how much is it paying me? And it's voice work? Okay, I can probably make this happen.
Oh, wait, I'm in.
He got some stupid amount. I don't have to
walk across glass and say yippee-ki-yay on a roof.
I think the
vision's great, though. The vision works really well. I think it's something creative. It was something fun. It was something different. And I love the original. I don't think it needed any of the sequels, but it did not need any of the sequels,
but it did spawn the sequels. And you know, I mean, obviously it did well enough that the studios thought they could really capitalize on it.
Voiced sperm. What the hell? Speaking of gross, the Human Centipede, that's another one. Now, look, I don't like these movies. It's not my kind of horror. I don't see the pleasure in jamming one man's head up another man's ass. It's just not for me. What you could do in your personal time is your business, and I leave you to it. But there's a lot of people who really love this kind of horror. I had this conversation with somebody recently who said it was discussed, and there's no way that was considered a success. But I'm like, well, they made like three of them, I think. Do you consider when they do movies like this, when people keep true to whatever crazy horror vision they have, is that a success in itself, the fact that they got it made and that people are talking about it? Isn't that already a success?
I mean, it is in my book. And you're right. It is a very specific genre of horror, the body horror movies. You know, you have to be of a certain mindset to find those truly entertaining, if it's not just for shock value. But I think it is a success. I think it was a success because they were able to convince some studio to make this movie, not once, not twice, but at least three times.
One long digestive system.
Oh, God.
Which is true, because the opening in your mouth goes all the way through to your butt, and it's one tube. It's
there's an old saying, it's like, if you're not the lead dog, the scene never changes.
All right, off that gross train. So let's go back to real cinematic vision, like crazy cinematic visions. And it really, James Cameron, we're going to talk about a couple of them. We're probably going to come back for a different one down the road. But this is a guy who I think needs to get full credit. Obviously, you've got masters in the director's chair. You've got Spielberg over the years, Lucas, Stanley Kubrick is a visionary by many respects. You have a lot of quality filmmakers out there. Tarantino, obviously, is someone that I would put in that same zip code. But James Cameron has done this multiple times, where he has taken the biggest swing you could possibly imagine and come out ahead. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, obviously Titanic is one of the most popular movies of all time. They gambled $200 million on this in the late 90s. When you didn't have that kind of money to spend, it took two studios to get it made because it was so expensive. He forewent his salary just to get it done. And it's a story about a boat crash that everybody already knew. And somehow,
knew the ending.
Yeah, I know exactly how it's going to end, and made it masterful. Won multiple Academy Awards, and you know, was just heralded as one of the greatest films of all time. And then you have Terminator 2 as well, which is a huge gamble. Spent a lot of money. The original movie, people might think it was a big, huge box office success. It was like 30 to 40 million box office. It wasn't huge. It was a cult success. People loved the character. And he said, give me more money. I'm going to make a better movie. I'm going to make the best Terminator movie you can make. And he did. Like, he actually did. And it's
been downhill ever since.
Well, that franchise maybe, but not him. I mean, he's still fine. Yeah. this guy's going to be okay. He's got all the submersibles Terminator. He needs.
Yeah, they found Terminator 1 after they saw Terminator 2, because Terminator 1 by itself did not do a lot on its own.
Mm-mm, no.
I remember seeing Terminator, the first one, in the theaters.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic movie to see in the theaters.
Man, if you watch it now, though, you're like,
oh, no, it does not hold up.
That one doesn't hold up. Terminator 2 does, though. Terminator 2 does.
The Terminator 2 could be a summer blockbuster today.
Yeah.
Easily.
Now, my question with those two movies in particular, right? And I know we'll probably talk about Avatar in a little bit, but we'll hold that. Because those two in particular were the two huge gambles. Just huge gambles. And he specifically saw a vision And he was doing everything he could to enact that vision, and he brought it to fruition. Would you say that that makes him one of the riskiest, even though studios gave him the money for it, one of the riskiest directors in history? Like riskier, if not riskiest.
Risque.
Yeah, he's very risky.
I don't think it's risky because...
You don't think that's risky?
Well, it's risky gambling the studio's money, yes. But at the same time, he's making a sequel, right? He's already got built-in capital for T2. So he knows people are going to come see it because there are people that have watched the first one. So it's not risky in that regard. Titanic, people know the story. People follow a lot of the, you know, history behind it. They do the diving to go find stuff from it. So it's already got a mass appeal into the concept of the boat itself. So I don't think either of those were risky. He just was smart to capitalize on it.
I agree. I mean, I think they saw, contrasting T2 and Titanic, I think they saw how well he took something that was a moderate success, turning it into a massive blockbuster success, and thought that the gamble wasn't really so much of a gamble as it was a gambit, to see if audiences would buy in to these, you know, mega cost movies. And it paid off, and you know, it kind of put him in a league of his own, being able to command and wield so much money to get his visions, a different, you know, all the different movies he's made have all been visually spectacular. You know, mm-hmm. he knows a good shot. He knows how to make something look really good. And I don't know that it's, you know, that the studio has ever really saw it as a risk so much as an investment in what they could make down the road.
I've always found it fascinating how he manages to keep getting all that money. But I guess when you keep making it back, people are going to keep giving it to you, right?
Right. you keep giving them money, they're going to keep giving you money.
I don't know if Todd Phillips is going to get that same investment on his next, unless he does Hangover 4, maybe.
Maybe the fans will give him the money this time around just to say, make the movie we wanted to see.
Right. He'll call Bradley Cooper up and be like, so what are you doing this weekend? Bradley's like, I don't know, man. I'm still chasing these Oscars. I ain't got time for that.
I think Ed Helms has probably got some time.
All right. So I'm going to segue over to this Zack Snyder situation. Because in all fairness, I know I don't want to go on a whole Zack Snyder, give him the ultimate cut of everything, because I just honestly am kind of tired of Zack Snyder at this point. I'm a little burned out on slow motion action, and he just doesn't seem to understand that maybe he should have someone else write his scripts because he's not a great writer.
No, he is not.
No, he's good visionary, bad writer. But why I wanted to bring these up is because, you know, he had ultimately a vision for the DC universe that he eventually brought to life, right? And he did cast, I think, very well for the characters, but he had a much darker take on what that world should be compared to what Marvel was doing. And so therefore, I think people automatically just were not fans of what he did. And I'm just curious, you know, now that the dust is settled, he's moved on, DC's revamped, everything else, and I'm talking specifically Batman versus Superman, the ultimate cut, Justice League, the actual 4-hour Zack Snyder cut, and Man of Steel, like his true visions. Would you consider those a success? Because I would. I do.
I most definitely would consider them, and do consider them, successes. I mean, I liked his dark and gritty vision for the DC universe, setting it apart from the, you know, popcorn, bright pink neon Marvel universe that we've had for so long. I mean, it was a nice contrast, and I thought it was great to take, you know, a squeaky clean character like Superman and give him a little bit more grit to work with, you know, like, you know, having spoiler alert, he kills somebody.
What?
which Superman never did in the comics, you know, forever. I don't know. I haven't followed the more recent comics of Superman, but up until that point, Superman had never killed anybody. At least, you know, they never said he had killed anybody. And this took it in a nice dark direction. And I think the vision that he had for these characters was good. The fact that they had to be coerced to release the Snyder cut for the Justice League and things like that, and the ultimate cut for Batman versus Superman was dumb. And it, like you, it made me very much gun shy when it comes to anything that he does these days. I'm burned out on I'm not going to watch the first version because there's going to be another version that's going to be what he actually wanted it to be. Or, you know, what was that? Rebel Moon.
Rebel Moon. Yeah.
Same damn thing. It's like, okay, I watched the first version. I'm not going to go back and watch the second version because I've been burned too many times before by this.
And do it right.
Zack Snyder's just flame.
You know, the thing is like, I think he pulled the wrong lesson was learned there, right? The lesson should have been, because of the way that those things panned out, those two movies, Batman vs. Superman and Justice League, should have been released in the versions that they were made to begin with. And then I think they would have been seen a whole lot differently. Instead, the lesson was, let's do these edited versions and put those out on Netflix, and we can double dip with the unrated ones. We'll make money like they did with Justice League. And I just don't think most people cared enough to do that. I mean, number one, you don't have established characters, Zack Snyder. I think you thought you were playing with, oh, I've got all this fandom, this is going to be great for me. Well, no, they also love those characters already. Right. So you had a built-in fan base to some degree.
I am not a fan of the Snyder DCU at all.
So you would say that those are not a success?
I think they were a success in what Snyder was trying to accomplish. I think for me personally, I did not like the DCU. Superman.
Superman wasn't in there. Are you sure you're talking about the right one?
Yeah. Superman for me was always, you know, Christopher Reeve. And Superman is always above everything from a statute of good. And there was no way Superman would ever kill somebody. And I absolutely love Smallville. I thought that was Tom Welling, I thought was great. So the fact that Tom Welling didn't continue on as Superman into the movies always bothered me. So
wow, that's like a very old bitter pill,
right?
the thing was that like Tom Welling never got to fly, and it's like now here's the chance for Tom to like make the next leap, and maybe Tom didn't want to do it. I don't know, but
no, they didn't want Tom. They didn't want Tom.
I know, which is annoying because everybody like watched Tom for 10 years as Superman.
Were you also upset that Grant Gustin didn't get to be the Flash?
No.
Well, you should have, because he was great. Like, he was so much better than Ezra Miller.
He was better than Ezra Miller.
He was.
But yeah, everything of the Bruce Willis Batman, like the Wonder
Bruce
Woman.
Willis? Ben Affleck?
Ben Affleck, whatever.
I'm not convinced you've seen these films anymore. First we have Spider-Man, now Bruce Willis is showing up, and he was talking as a baby in Batman's mouth or something. Right. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Ben Affleck is Batman. None of it was good. Wonder Woman, the first Wonder Woman movie was awesome. Like that hit the pieces, right? It was interesting enough, good enough, like hit all the points. It was like a little jokey. It had all the softness to it that it needed to have. Like DCU, granted, it is a little darker, a little grittier than the Marvel side of the house. But I mean, commercially, it was a success. The fans loved it. They talk about the ones that really, really loved it, love it. You know, so yes, was it successful? Was it a great vision, great idea for that purpose? Sure. But yeah, for me, it was not Superman. I have a hard time with Man of Steel.
Okay.
And even more hard time with Batman versus Superman because
it was just Martha.
So bad.
We can all agree that was stupid. Like that. That was just dumb. But you'll be happy, Troy, because Crypto is going to show up in the new Superman. James Gunn released a still, and so you're going to get a little puppy love in the next one.
There we go.
Cool.
If you say so.
Yeah, I'm super excited to see Saturday morning cartoons back.
I love Saturday morning cartoons.
I'd rather have Henry Cavill. Yeah, I would. I said it. So then we move on to the... Now, this is a vision, okay? And I think... Rob, you've read this. I don't know if you tried. Didn't you read this book?
Yeah. Oh,
you both read it? Okay. So there's a book written by a guy who created a fake religion. And John Travolta wanted to get this made for so long. Like, this is his dream project, bringing this thing to life to pay tribute to his glorious overlord, whatever. And that was Battlefield Earth.
Oh, no. Sorry. I skipped ahead because I thought you were talking about something else. I did not read the book for Battlefield Earth.
I read pretty much everything that L. Ron Hubbard wrote until the whole Dianetics and Scientology stuff came out.
So So what made you stop reading them, if you don't mind me asking? Now I'm curious.
Well, I read through the Battlefield Earth, and then I read through the whole Mission Earth series, which I believe, if memory serves, it was 12 books. And that it was fantastic. It was a very satirical take on society at the time and where he thought society was going. But as they progressed, you got towards the end of the book, a lot more of the kookiness started showing. And then shortly after, the Dianetics book was released. You know, it's supposed to be your new blueprint for a better life. And then Scientology poked its head up, and I was like, all right, you know, I've read all the stuff I want to read from this guy. I don't need to go any further.
Fair enough. So do you think, and I couldn't tell you the plot of Battlefield Earth if I wanted to. I honestly do not know. I watched it and I do not know what the plot is.
It's because very much like, World War Z, the book and the movie have very little in common.
Okay, fair enough. Were you at all, because you read the books, were you excited at all for that movie?
I was. I had high hopes for it. I mean, it was one of my favorite books as a kid. I loved this giant, epic, space-based, you know, aliens coming to Earth and Earthlings trying to fight back and getting pushed down and all that, the big struggle. It was a giant book. I think it was almost 1,000 pages, you know, and I read this when I was like 11 or 12, I think is when I read it. And I thought, you know, I had super high hopes. I'm like, cool, they're going to take this story. They're going to have all these cool looking aliens. And what did we get? We got John Travolta dressed up like a cross between a member of Kiss and Gwar.
Great vision.
That's what we got. It was terrible. The acting was terrible. The sets didn't look good. And at the time, I mean, granted, to be fair, CGI and special effects at the time were not anywhere near as good as they are these days, because it's, you know, it's an older movie. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I swear they went as cheap as possible on everything. I mean, John Travolta's character was literally just, you know, wearing like Gene Simmons boots and had dreadlocks, you know, that is not the vision I had for the aliens in this movie. It was, I don't know. It dashed any hope of there ever being a good, version of this movie for me.
And he traded in his revamped celebrity and box office prowess to make this, like, mm-hmm. That was a big gamble on his part. And I want to say, on Rotten Tomatoes, it is a 3% on the critics rating. And I just want to know, who are those 3%? Like, I want to dig into that a little bit and find those guys and just be like, what did you see?
They're friends. Yeah. Friends of Travolta.
They're friends with Travolta. One of them's Tom Cruise. And then there's two other guys. Yeah.
It's the author of the book.
No, he was dead by then.
Would you still welcome another stab at this?
I don't think so. I think that they ruined this one for me. I think what would be better, rather than a movie for this, I think a long form television show could be successful, because, you know, you can't take a book that's 1,000 or so pages and put it into a 2-hour format. You just can't. You're going to lose so much. There's so much, you know. L. Ron Hubbard was one of those authors who put a lot of work into the detail of his worlds. I mean, meticulous, like, detail in some aspects. I don't think, unless you're going to do it like, you know, Peter Jackson style, where it's three movies that are all, you know, 3 hours long, I don't think you're going to be able to have anybody take a stab at this and make it something that would be worth watching, at least for me.
Do you think the Scientology of it all really left a mark in terms of people ever wanting to touch this property again? Not just because a lot of bad movies get remade.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, because there's a whole stigma around everything, you know, that Scientology controls or touches. And I believe they have control of the L. Ron Hubbard estate. So, because, I mean, you know, it was his quote unquote foundation that started the religion. And I honestly believe that religion was started as a joke, and then some people just started believing it.
I think, isn't that what L. Ron Hubbard was trying to do? Let me see if this will work. Oh, yeah. It did.
Yeah.
So it's wild. I won't knock anyone's religion except that one. That's just one that I'm sorry. I can't give you. I just can't.
Your thetans are not little, clear, my friend.
That one I think is universal as a failure. But and then you've got Stanley Kubrick, who is a famously visionary director, right? And he's done a lot of classic films. He's 2001, The Shining, Full Metal Jacket. What's that?
Eyes Wide Shut.
Eyes Wide Shut. I guess you can include that if you would like to. I wouldn't. I'm not a fan of The Shining. I've gone on record of saying that many times because I love that book and I hate what he's done to it. But any of those particular films, I don't know which one to really call out, but I would probably lean into 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of an audacious vision, that's probably one where I think he was going for something crazy almost. I mean, very, very, it was just a wild vision. The opening alone, I mean, Barbie tried to duplicate it. So yeah. Many other movies have tried to duplicate
so
it.
So many too. Other
pretty movies. Much, yeah. Pretty much shot for shot.
Yeah. I mean, it's been, it's something that has stood the test of time. It's not fair to really look back on something that old and be like, well, do you think it stands the test of time? But that seems to be a film where its crazy vision has managed to stand the test of time. Whether you like it or not, for whatever reason, that is a very memorable film to many people.
Oh, for sure.
Why do you think that one stands out?
I think because it was just so out there for the time. I mean, I remember seeing this movie for the first time and going, what the fuck am I watching? You know, I mean, I had read the book 2001 and I saw this movie and I was like, I think I need to be on drugs to understand what he's trying to convey here. I mean, and I mean, you take this story and then you mix in some psychotropics and then, you know, there you go. You got yourself the Stanley Kubrick's version of 2001.
The full Kubrick experience.
Yeah. The visuals were just groundbreaking. The way he interwove like all the different, you know, things that he put into this movie, like the color spectrums and stuff that you see. And like, you know, just the transitions, like in the scene where I can't remember the main character's name, where he goes through all the life stages, going from a baby to an adult to being, you know, an octogenarian. And then he's in that bedroom, then it switches and it becomes this dark, you know, scene that's full of stars. It's like at the time, the way he did this stuff was groundbreaking and innovative. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why this one has stood the test of time, not because it's a great movie, because I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's a good movie. And mm-hmm. I think it was a movie that opened the doors for a lot of other people to make great movies and to take things that, you know, that they wanted to make into a story and expand them and add their own vision to them.
Is that kind of going back to what you were saying earlier about inspiration?
Yeah.
Right. It's seen by many as, well, that's a great movie, but when you go watch it, I don't like it. I don't like it personally, but I can watch it and go, okay, I get why this would be so revered to people who make films later. Like,
yeah,
this could an explosion of creativity in people. It could create that.
Yeah. And I think the big thing for that movie is that it's commercially successful now, and it's also artistically successful because when you think about its message and meaning, it really is talking about life and this concept of the future. We always looked in the past like, oh, the year 2000 is going to be all of this, you know, space and technology and robots and everything of that nature. And so to put the 2001 sticker on it is basically like, what does life look like then? And as we progress through the movie, you're seeing life evolve as the movie goes on. And I think it's a really interesting story when you look at it from that perspective versus trying to figure out what the actually going on during the course of the movie, right? It is not a movie that you follow from A to B to Z. It is this is how life moves, and life moves in various different ways as it heads to its ultimate termination at the end.
And another movie that's very much like that, at least for me, was Interstellar. It had the same exact kind of feel to it. It's not a movie that goes from A to B to C down the line. It's one of those you have to take a step back and look at it from the 10 million mile view and see the overarching vision that they had for it and the way it went. Because that's another movie very much like 2001 that I think, while it's not a great movie, it's a good movie. I liked the movie. I think it's one of those ones that also serves to inspire other would-be directors or directors of photography or things, whatever, in the movie business to try new things, because, you know, you can make a movie that is absolutely gorgeous, even if it's not a super success.
Yeah. Because I mean, imagine the pitch for that. Like, we're going to basically show you what's inside of a black hole. Yeah. Nobody knows what's inside of a black hole.
Right.
But we're going to show you what's inside of a black hole. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, roll with it. Let's go. Let's see what happens.
And that segues right into, to Barbie. Believe it or not, you know, it's got the opening. But I also, like, I feel like not enough people give that movie enough credit for that was a bold strategy. I mean, that's a movie that's completely about it's really talking about feminism and modern identity politics and things like that. And it's doing it in a fun, zippy, quippy, upbeat kind of way with an entire world that's designed around toys. And I would put that in the same vein as a Kubrick, because I could see that inspiring filmmakers in the future.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they took one of the world's most iconic toys and gave it a coming of age story.
Yeah.
And the visuals in this movie, again, are ones that just pop off the screen. It is so vibrant and everything just feels the way you would expect it from if you're trying to look at it from Barbie's perspective. The way the world is, it's like all this over the top, everything's great, everything's perfect kind of world. And then, you know, men come in and trample on it and they have to basically figure out how to fix what we fuck up.
Like we do.
Yeah. It's very much art imitating life.
And even just the juxtaposition of like inside of Barbie land where everything seems to be peachy, rosy and fun and bright. And then you come to the real world and you realize that, oh, like I don't play with dolls anymore and dolls are stupid and I have too many of my other problems and the internet has taken over everything. It's like just seeing how we've lost our innocence in the teens that are there and how just vicious they are to Barbie when they're talking to her.
Yep.
Like how do we devolve as a society from, you know, this happy-go-lucky, I could be anything. I have all these different versions of careers and concepts and fun and excitement to, like, you know, go F yourself. Like,
yeah. Yeah. This is one of those movies for me. I mean, I found this movie to be many things. You know, for me, I found it to be funny. I found it parts of it to be tender. I mean, it was fantastic. And then it was very poignant with the way society is. I mean, you know, as Aaron, you know, said, talking about feminism and girl power, and it was a very positive spin on the whole girl power and feminism thing. And I think it'll inspire, if it doesn't inspire, like, you know, people in the movie business, it'll inspire little girls all around the world to try and make things better for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And make movies for themselves. I still don't understand why studios haven't made more female focused projects like that. But, you know, studios are going to do what they're going to do.
Studios.
Yeah, exactly. I got to break in one more time because I got to tell you about this other movie. And I think you've probably heard about this, but Twisters, you can own or rent that now. It's on digital right now. Or look for the 4K Ultra HD and Blu-ray on October 22nd. The blockbuster disaster epic starring Daisy Edgar Jones, Glenn Powell, and Anthony Ramos is packed with a whirlwind of heart-stopping action and exhilarating thrills. We Live Entertainment called Twisters the perfect blockbuster, and you can watch that at home now with over 1 hour of exclusive bonus content. And I will add to that, we talked about this when it came out in the summer. Love this movie. Absolutely love Twisters. It was very hard to live up to the original, but by God, they did it. So you definitely have to check out Twisters if you haven't already. And I don't know if you heard, but Glenn Powell is kind of a big deal. So check out Twisters and we'll get back to the topic. So you guys had a couple you wanted to mention before we move out of this topic. Who wanted to talk in order? I mean, here?
I'll start with one that we talk about a lot here on The Hollywood Outsider, and we have an episode of Remake This Movie Right that covers this particular movie. It's The Room, probably the worst movie ever made, yet we still talk about it nonstop today. It's almost as if Lisa herself is tearing us apart.
Nah.
or we just can't take our eyes off of that nice little doggy in the store. The movie may not be a favorite, but I mean, Tuxedo Football, other great gimmicks that happen in this, we're always going to say, oh, hi, Mark. every single time we see a mark walking down the street. I mean, success commercially, no. Success in the fact that people will know the name Tommy Wiseau till the day they die is, I think, super awesome. So, I mean, if I'm Tommy Wiseau, and even if I think it's the greatest movie ever, because Tommy's probably a little bit messed in the head, but Tommy's gonna die going like, I made this. Like, this is out there. Like, I am so cool. I'm your favorite customer. It's like, I don't understand, like, what goes on. And then the fact that we made a movie about
making the movie.
It's like, that never should have happened. But yeah, Tommy's just sitting there going like, here, yeah, call this number and get my underwear. It's like, I don't know what else to say. The room is a crazy vision that never should have happened and yet will always exist in infamy.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Aaron.
I firmly agree with everything you said. I do think if you're going to have a conversation about crazy cinematic visions, and I'll be honest, man, just I could go down a rabbit hole of movie after movie after movie where we could have a discussion about it. I just wanted to pick some. I just went through and picked some obvious ones and some also less obvious ones. The Room has got to be at the top of the list. I understand you have your Kubricks and you've got your George Lucas and everything, but you got to have the guys that just went for broke. You might hate this movie, and you're right to do so. I mean, it's fair, right? It's not a good movie.
It's not a good movie.
But it's also a marvelous movie.
It's so bad that you can't not watch it.
Exactly, and it brings Tricking people games, together.
You can get whatever you want to do. Make a game for every Nerf games. Like, you can make any kind of game you want while you watch this movie.
It's amazing, and I will say, like, it's kind of in the same vein as a Rocky Horror Picture Show. They made that was a crazy vision to bring that to life and the world of film, and it didn't play well. And then it started getting like midnight showings, and that's how The Room became popular. Right? It just became a cult success where people love to just get together with friends and watch it. Now, different reasons they want to see Rocky Horror because, hey, you know, we get to see an expression of different sexuality and different ideas. Where The Room is, let's go make fun of this fucking guy who made this goddamn movie. Because what was that? But I bet you even him, whether he, and I have seen him in interviews and whatnot, and he stands that he likes the movie and everything else. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm sure he loves the fact that it's going to live on, that it's now infamous. And it's probably inspired a whole, back to inspiration, it's probably inspired a whole generation of bad filmmakers to believe that they can do this themselves, make this happen again. So we're going to get continue to get people that are just not trying too hard.
Oh, for sure.
But it'll also inspire good filmmakers too.
I mean, there's always going to be a market for those direct to digital movies.
Movie bowls. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one to mention.
It's a fantastic one to mention.
YouTube generation, right? I could put anything I want on YouTube and I can get people to watch it. And then YouTube will say, oh, look at that. It's got a million views. Dude, I get an award.
I firmly believe in the next 10 years, you're going to see great filmmakers emerge from TikTok and stuff like that. Because, I mean, some of the stuff on there is impressive. I mean, it's just, honestly, it's impressive. So,
yeah. Well, there's a creator I follow on YouTube called Kane Pixels, who does found footage type stuff of backrooms. You guys familiar with the backrooms mythology? It's from Mm-mm. Creepypasta. It's
I think so, but you want to explain it for people that
liminal don't know. Horror. So basically what happens is people fall in between cracks in reality and end up in this liminal space that doesn't really make sense, couldn't really exist in the physical world. So there's this creator on YouTube called Kane Pixels who has announced that he was approached by A24 Ooh. To make a movie from you know, in the same universe that he has made all his YouTube videos from. So it's going to be a liminal horror movie that takes place in the back rooms. And there's a whole mythology. If you look this up on YouTube, there's several different creators who make these things. And it all started with him trying to figure out how to use Blender. So he was making these 3D rendered environments. And then he just started making this stuff. And he read something on Creepypasta, I think is how it goes, about the liminal spaces. And he started making a horror little shorts for YouTube, trying to figure out how to use this 3D rendering software, and just went from there. I mean, you're going to see other things like that happen because there's a lot of creativity out there.
That's awesome.
Now I'm just thinking about the Thinny from Stephen King again.
Oh my God. Yes. There we go.
The Thinnies.
Full circle.
Yeah. So one I wanted to bring up was a James Cameron one, and it's okay. The Avatar series. I mean, it was a success as far as commercially goes, and for his vision, because this is another one of those, you know, as I put it in my notes, how do you take the story of Pocahontas and punch it up? $237 million and place that movie in space. Oh, and make the native people 12 feet tall and blue skinned. That's how you take the story of Pocahontas and you punch it up. I mean, how did this get made? You know, it's not an original story by any sense at all. Mm-mm. How did he
not even an original name or a concept behind the elements?
Yeah, either. No, unobtainium. You know, it's crazy. You know, how does this happen? Well, because he's James Cameron. That's how it happens.
Yeah.
You know, the studios have seen he can take pretty much anything and make money with it. It was visually stunning. The story wasn't worth a shit, but it was visually stunning, and the acting was for the most part was just okay. I mean, Sam Worthington is not my favorite actor. He's not that great of an actor as far as I'm concerned.
He's no one's favorite actor except his mom.
But you know, I don't know. One thing that always did bother me about that, and I don't know how it slipped by, was the way the Na'vi people tame their beasts. They use, you know, they use that tail thing off the back of their head, which is also the same thing they use when they mate.
Did
no one ever go up to James Cameron and go, "Yo, Jim, this is like bestiality, man. Do you not see it?"
Yeah. No, I got a different visual of all that.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing that never sat well with me. And I've said this to Aaron multiple times when we've talked about the Avatar movies, is I love the way they look. They are gorgeous movies. And, you know, he has pushed the boundaries on special effects with his movies, and he has pushed mm-hmm. the boundary on just scale and scope of the worlds that he creates with these movies. But, you know, are they a success from that perspective? Yes. Are they a success commercially? Yeah, sure. Cause everybody wants to see the next big spectacle. But for me, they've always just been a little off.
The first one, like, I think it's a success because I sat through that movie in IMAX, the AWA seats literally sitting on my shoulder. Like, it was like the 3D experience was so surreal that you were so immersed in that movie that, like, I think I've said a number of times on this show, when Home Tree falls, I literally sobbed out loud because I was just like, I can't believe they're killing the planet, basically. And like, I'm crying for an inanimate object. Like, what is going on here? And the fact that he can make you feel that kind of emotion for the space, the sacred place of the Na'vi, I think he does a really great job. And then he goes and says, and then let's just go make Titanic, you know, in the second movie and recap what happened in the first movie in the first hour.
Right.
And the second movie is just garbage compared to the first movie.
But
it loses something.
Visually, it's gorgeous. It's,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, give that whale an Oscar. That's the best action I've seen all year.
And one thing that I thought was funny is that with The Way of Water is I remember watching it going, how did he make water look better digitally than real?
Right.
He made water look better
because there's no pollution.
No hypodermic needles floating in it.
Didn't have a swirl of plastic in the middle. That's what it was missing.
Pekin would be like, what is this? I can't get through.
No, I'm firmly convinced James Cameron, you could, any studio would give him $250 million to make whatever he wanted at this point.
They'd probably give him $250 million to make a movie about the phone book.
Yeah. I mean, he'd make an awesome phone book movie. That'd be great. Now, there's one last one. I don't know which of you this is, but you get to sell it, not me.
Oh, that's me. And okay. It's one of my favorites. Okay. I go back.
This is a crazy cinematic vision. Keep in mind, people.
I love this movie.
I also love this movie.
It is some of the weirdest shit you've ever watched. But I mean, it's not like you can actually make a good movie about a horny duck from a foreign planet who travels to Earth and then gets to bang Leah Thompson. I mean, like who didn't love Leah Thompson in the 80s, right? Space Camp and Back to the Future. And
if I was Marty, I probably would have. I'm just saying.
I totally would have. But the thing with Howard the Duck is that you have to decide if you're making an interspecies sex comedy or if you're making a kids movie. And you cannot combine the two, which is what they did in the Howard the Duck. But, I mean, I thought it was great. I thought it was a fantastic time. I laughed. I cried. I was cheering on Howard. And Howard was just this foul-mouthed sex fiend walking around and patting chicks on the ass. And it was just like, what is going on right now in this? And then there's the giant monster at the end of the movie.
Yep.
I mean, it literally was like, okay, we're going to take this weird ass creature from a Marvel comic and try to do something with it. And then he gets to show up again and redeem himself in Guardians of the Galaxy,
which was so fantastic. Which is great. Yeah. I loved that he was in that. And I mean, yeah, he doesn't look like he did in the '80s because, you know, he doesn't look like an animatronic puppet in the Guardians of the Galaxy. But, I loved, and now they're talks, you know, I think they're still in talks to actually make another Howard the Duck movie.
They might down the road. I don't know where that's at or if that's a thing still or if it's just speculation.
It'd be better
know.
Than whatever else Marvel's put out lately.
Right.
Except for Wolverine X Deadpool Wolverine versus Deadpool's
Nanny.
Deadverine.
Yep. that one was funny to me because, well, number one, that's George Lucas as well. I mean, he's a producer. He didn't
executive producer. Yeah.
He didn't direct it, but he helped get that made. And I just love that someone somewhere, once again, this is one of those where you're in the back lot and somebody's making this pitch like, look, we got a duck. All right. We got Marty's mom. And what we're going to do is we're going to put them together. They're going to hook up. Wait, the chick's going to bang the duck. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's going to happen. And it's going to be awesome. Sure. What? Why would we make this movie? Well, George Lucas is going to produce it. Okay, make that happen.
Sold.
That's exactly how that movie got made. I think George Lucas isn't involved. This never happens. It never happens.
Never.
Now, that, I actually own a copy of that movie. I mean, it's that endearing to me. I've had a copy of that movie forever.
I could respect that.
I could totally respect that.
I can respect that. And I would encourage anybody listening, tag the show and put out like your favorite crazy cinematic visions that have made it to film or success or positive, negative, whatever. I'm just kind of curious what other people think of when they think of this kind of broad topic, because there's so many out there to discuss. I mean, I even thought about like, you could throw Clue in here because Clue took a board game and made, in my opinion, one of the best comedies of all time.
And that was a gamble when they did it. I mean, and I agree. It's one of my favorite comedies of all time. I mean, I'm a huge Tim Curry fan to begin with. But,
oh God,
Tim but, Curry! You know, that movie worked on so many levels for me. Like just in terms of comedic timing and the way the characters interacted with each other, and the fact that there were three different endings to this movie. That depending on where you saw it in the theaters at the time, you got to see a different ending.
Yeah. People don't remember that. That bugs me that people don't remember that unless you actually went through it.
Yeah.
It was one of the coolest experiences.
I went to three different theaters so I could see the three different endings because I left it the first time and someone told me, hey, you know, this theater's got a different ending than the theater that I saw it. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then sure as shit,
someone else did it.
I went and saw it and I'm like, holy cow. And then someone else said, yeah, there's three endings. So I had to seek out the third one to try and find all three endings. And
literally fighting with your friends going like, you're wrong. Like, no, that this guy did it. This guy. No. I saw like, did you see the same movie?
Right.
Yeah. That was a great experience. And then it came on video and it was like, well, here are the three endings all at once. I'm like, oh, that's not as cool though. It wasn't as cool. Cause it was like, it was work to see. And I went to three theaters and only saw two because two of the theaters were playing the same ending. And I'm like, God, it sucks. What's the third? I didn't see the third one until it finally hit video. I was so mad. And that was one where all of them did it. Man. See, there's so many. We could just go on and on.
Yeah, this is a topic that could go on for hours.
It could. So if you guys think of something cool, just tag us, post it on Facebook in the comments or on X at Buy Popcorn or at The Hollywood Outsider on Facebook and Threads and all that jive. Oh, okay. Well, that was fun. Thanks for the conversation on that. That was very insightful and I think interesting. Now I would want to ask, Rob, you alluded because our last episode was about Stephen King centric and you said you had thoughts.
Yeah.
Fill them in.
So one thing that, I pointed this out before we actually started recording, but I'm going to point it out again that Troy was talking about Kingdom Hospital, which is not a Stephen King story. It's a reimagining of a Danish show called The Kingdom, which is same exact storyline, little bit different take on it. The Danish one is actually a little more dark and macabre than Kingdom Hospital was. It's available out out on the internet. I don't think it's streaming anywhere anymore, but it's only available in Danish, so you're going to have to find it with subs. You're going to have to read because there's no dubbed version.
That's a lot of work.
A lot of work, but it is worth it. And you know, I didn't agree. You had made a statement that that most of Stephen King's adaptations were good. And there were some that were bad.
Yeah, you feel different.
I feel the exact opposite. I think most adaptations of Stephen King's work have been garbage with a few standouts that are really good. I did agree with The Mist, with Darabont. I think his ending was much better than the book. And even, I mean, and you said it, Stephen King agreed that his ending was much better than the book. And it was so much darker than the book. Because, you know, the book's, oh, it just keeps coming and keeps coming. Whereas this is like, oh shit, he fucked up.
but you correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Yep.
A big reason why you feel differently than I do is I'm more a movie guy than a book guy.
Right.
I watch more movies than I read books. You read everything.
I read everything.
You want to see so much of that brought to life. Is that fair?
That is fair. Yeah. And as I've said before, my favorite series of books by Stephen King is the Dark Tower series. Mm-hmm. And much like Troy, I did the same thing when it said you can close the book and stop here. I did for about an hour, and I wish I would have never opened it up because that ending just killed me. I was like, you motherfucker.
So it really does end perfect, and then he ruins it?
It's not a perfect ending. It's a good ending, and then if you continue reading, it's bad.
And at that point, is it hard to reset your mind to where you left off?
Yeah. Honestly, I don't think if you get past the part where you're not supposed to read and you do finish the reading, I actually don't think it's a bad ending because he set that up at the very beginning. And you were like, I am so stupid that I did not see that. So I feel dumb that I finished the book.
I felt because, it was a cop out.
Mm. Oh, really?
The ending was a cop out. I mean, I get it. It's Ka, everything's a wheel. Everything has to follow Ka. Yeah, okay. But I thought that the way he ended it was a cop out. I did not like how he inserted himself into the one book. I did not like that at all. I thought it was.
Oh, you didn't like Song of Susanna?
Where he like broke the fourth wall.
Yeah,
of the
he's in the story.
Yeah, Roland actually comes to our world and interacts with Stephen King directly.
And I thought that was just pandering. I didn't care for that part at all. I understand why he did it because, you know, he just had a brush with death and was having an existential crisis and things like that. But
which Roland was going through at the exact same time as a character.
Right. I get it. I just didn't like it. unlike Troy, I love the way it starts with the first book. I mean, you can't have a more iconic opening line than the man in black fled across the desert and the gunslinger followed. I mean, that was what hooked me. I have a first edition, first print run of this book because I loved it that much. I have five copies of the gunslinger.
I didn't say it was bad. I said it's hard for like mainstream people to get into it because it starts in the middle.
Right.
Of the story.
And that's why they did the revised edition of book one, where they retconned some stuff and they changed a few things around so that it makes more sense and has more continuity. But, you know, I don't think when he wrote the first book, he actually knew where this was going to go. I think he had like, here's a concept of a plan. and I think
that plan was to take this type of drugs at this point and this type of drugs at this point.
And the other ones of his, I'm a sucker for the non-traditional horror. So like, I loved The Mist. I loved 11/22/63. I love 1408 because it's not your traditional, it's a haunted hotel room. I mean, a room in a hotel that's haunted. How cool is that?
That was very cool. Yeah.
So I've got lots of thoughts on Stephen King and Stephen King things. And much like your mom, I've read everything. One of my favorite recent books of his was Fairy Tale. I thought it was a fantastic story. I think it would make a great movie if somebody were to really take it on and do it well.
My mom's reading that now. Actually, she was a little late to it, but she's reading it now.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites of the more recent works.
So let's move on to some recommendations. If you have anything you want to recommend, I want to talk about one that I just saw. It's called Leroy, Texas. I had never heard of this movie. It's an indie flick, but I love the Coen brothers, especially early Coen brothers. We're talking like Blood Simple, stuff like that. It eerily reminiscent of that with dark humor and just where the hell is this going? How is this going to end? And it's follow Steve Zahn's in it as a private investigator. And then you have this kind of lumpy husband who's married to a sketchy wife, and you've got a hitman involved. And, you know, I don't want to say anything because I don't want to ruin it, because it really is watch it unravel kind of movie. But if you like Coen brothers and you want to see something about like this dusty Texas town where everybody's trying to get theirs and they want to get a little extra cash. And then you've got one guy in the center who's just a little bit dopey and just can't stand on his own 2 feet. Then you have Steve Zahn as a private investigator, kind of like nudging everything forward, and a hitman and murder and money. It's fun. It's just like, it's a fun ride. And I love these kinds of movies where I didn't know where it was going to go, because it does take several really unique twists. And I thought it was really enjoyable and streaming all over the place, but Leroy, Texas, I recommend that one heavily.
I've got a couple that I would recommend people see, and they both kind of fit in with this with this discussion that we've been having. Okay. About visions. The first one is going to be Things Will Be Different.
You watched that?
I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think it's not the most original story.
I recommended that one to you.
You did recommend it to me. All right. And I'm going to recommend that anybody who has liked movies like Safety Not Guaranteed, Primer, Dave Made a Maze, things like that, indie flicks that are a little bit off kilter, not quite what you expect, this is going to fall right into that same wheelhouse. It's a time travel movie, but it's not a time travel movie. Mm-hmm. It is very much a liminal story. It takes place in a liminal space, which is actually fantastic, which is what I really enjoyed about it. It's like someone took a different twist on the liminal sci-fi / horror genre, mixed it with time travel and causality. Mm-hmm. It's a great movie.
And family dynamics too, because there are some strong family dynamics.
There is. Involved. What's her name? Riley Dandy. I think she does a great job in this. And Adam Thompson is the male lead. And he does a great job. I think they have good chemistry together. Mm-hmm. And it plays into the old adage, you know, without spoiling anything, if you keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, it's insanity. And it plays into that so well. And it's so well shot with such a small budget. I mean, it's not a big budget movie, very, very few characters in it. It's very, centered around, you know, basically three people, for the
yeah,
movie.
I mean, essentially brother and sister, they're trying to escape from a robbery, end up in this farmhouse, and then things happen, right? Like, yep. That's the basic setup without giving anything away. And it's just a lot more than it would ever seem.
Yeah. And then my second recommendation for people, again, going with vision, I wrote a review on this one in the Hollywood Outsider group on Facebook, was Hellboy, mm-hmm. the Crooked Man. Absolutely loved the visuals and the style that they went for. It's a very, very much a low budget, dirty, gritty, more based in reality, Hellboy. So take the visions of the Guillermo del Toro stuff and just throw it away. don't even think about those being in the same realm as this. It's another one of those. I mean, I loved it. It was low budget, but it was compelling storytelling, and the vision that they had for it was so close to what the original comic and story arc was, that it was amazing for me.
Well, the one of the writers was Mike Mignola.
Yeah,
right?
Mike Mignola was one of the writers for the screenplay. And if you ever get the chance to meet Mike Mignola, he's a fantastic individual.
That's cool.
When we went to Comic-Con, I had a 35-minute conversation with him, because there was literally nobody at his booth.
That's just sad. It's just sad. Well, I watched that on your recommendation, and actually I was pleasantly surprised. Now, I will say the effects are not the
greatest.
Best. It's not a big budget movie. There's a cool spider fight, like right at the beginning. And I'm like, okay, it's cheesy, but it's in that Army of Darkness kind of way where I'm like, I like it. I like it. I like it. And I really like, is it Jack Kesey?
Jack Kesey? 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 I don't know how you pronounce his last name.
Tomato, tomato. But he does a very good Hellboy. Yeah. I mean, it's not Ron Perlman, but he does his own version of it. Like very noir detective.
But he's a lot closer to the comic version of Hellboy than Ron Perlman was. Ron Perlman was the big bombastic, you know, hero rah rah rah. This guy's more of the noir detective, kind of like grim and gritty.
I like that. I did. And before you move on, you also saw a movie called The Substance, which has been, I think it's coming to video. I think it's already out of theaters, but it's pretty close to being out of theaters by the time you hear this, but it's coming to video so you can rent it. That's where Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley?
Qualley. I remember I saw her in an interview and she said it's pronounced like Wally, but with a Q.
Okay.
Well, Qualley.
Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley are the same character.
Yep.
Right. It's basically Demi Moore is just looking for the fountain of youth as an actress kind of thing.
It is, but there's a twist on it. So they're the same.
Don't spoil the twist.
No. The same character, but they're not.
Interesting. it's body horror. Is this body horror?
It's very much. Yeah. It's very, it very much Cronenberg-esque.
And you recommended this one pretty highly. Right?
Yeah. As long as you go into it knowing that the third act just goes off the fucking rails.
Is that the case where it could have been a fantastic movie, but the last, whatever,
30 minutes or something? In my opinion, if they had trimmed it 20 minutes, it would have been a perfect film. It would have gotten like a 9, like as I said in my review, it would have given an 8 or a 9 out of 10. As it stands, I gave it a 6, I believe, is what I gave it. Yeah, I mean, the ending just, it just ruined it for me, ruined everything that they had built up over the course of the first, you know, hour and a half. They basically tore down in the last 20 minutes.
That's too bad.
But yeah, it was a great movie. If you're into body horror, that isn't too grotesque. There's a couple shocking scenes, and the ending is over the top, but, the storyline itself is good. It's good storytelling. It's shot well. And the actors are believable. I mean, Demi Moore still looks good.
Let me do this because I can't believe I didn't do this. If $10 is the full price of admission, I would give Leroy, Texas, $7.50. Loved it. And then you had three films, and you already gave The Substance 6.
Yep. Hellboy, I think I gave that a 7.
Okay.
Might have been an 8. I don't remember. And then Things Will Be Different. I'm going to give it, just in on context alone, I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay, perfect. Troy, you have any recommendations you want to mention before we head out?
I mean, mine's a little bit old and dated, but I did go see My Old Ass with Aubrey Plaza. That movie was actually surprisingly much better than I ever thought it was going to be. It's basically a coming-of-age 18-year-old that's going to be leaving their family farm to go to the big city, go to college or whatever, you know, just basically very selfish about herself. And she goes out with some friends and takes some shrooms and ends up having a trip that basically allows her to talk to her future self. And the future self and her have these conversations, and there's a gimmick about how they can like text each other and talk on the phone. But the whole movie is basically based around the fact that the older self tells the younger self that she should not have a summer fling with this boy. And the whole movie then is about how she tries to avoid having this summer relationship with this boy and just gets more and more attracted to him until you find out why at the end. And
this is a cool concept.
Yeah, it was I thought it was fascinating, and I got to the end and I bawled my eyes out, and it was just like, it was so good. And Aubrey Plaza is really great in it. She's not her usual quirky self. She's actually like very serious, especially what she has to do at the end of the movie. I would highly recommend. It's probably coming out on video soon. It's been out in the theater now for a little bit, but yeah, definitely go see My Old Ass. It was really, really good.
What do you give that one? $10 full price admission.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd give it a solid $7.50.
Okay. Look at this. A lot of great movies you can if you can find them.
And then my other recommendation, because the trailer just dropped.
Joker 2.
Arjun and I, we talked about this a lot when it first happened, but Silo season 2.
Oh, yeah.
The trailer dropped. You have 4 weeks. It comes out November 15th. You got 4 weeks to watch the first season.
Read the book.
$22.99 gets you all three books from Amazon in the complete box set right now. It is so good to see Tim Robbins play, and Aaron and I talk about this all the time, a villain doesn't know that they're a villain because they think they're doing the right thing.
Right.
Tim Robbins is so good in this role. Rebecca Ferguson as the protagonist, so good in this role.
She was the perfect cast choice as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, and when you see the season two trailer, like, oh my God, I cannot wait. I'm like, I wish it would drop that whole weekend because I would sit down and
just binge the hell out of it.
Like, I need to go back to that one and try it again.
It is really great. It's basically what would happen if Game of Thrones took place inside of a missile silo in a post-nuclear Earth.
Yep. Yeah. Most of Hugh Howey's original source material is fantastic. Like the entire Silo series, Shift, Wool,
Shift, and Dust. Yeah.
He's also got another one called Sand. It takes place in the same universe, just different part of the world. Also a fantastic book. If you're more into the sci-fi stuff, he has Beacon 23, which was a short-lived show on, I think it was on the Paramount Network. I don't remember which one it was on.
Oh, wow.
That had, can't remember her name. She was in Game of Thrones. Cersei.
Lena Headey.
She was in it. Yeah. It was only two seasons long. It got the axe, but based on another Hugh Howey book, also great, great TV. It just didn't get the eyeballs on it.
Yeah, I mean, and this genre of stuff is usually in the same vein as like Three Body Problem on Netflix. That was a big hit recently. So if you like Three Body Problem, you'll definitely like Silo. If you like Foundation, you would love Silo. Yep. Right, Asimov is kind of in that same vein, but I cannot say enough good things about the Silo TV show. The casting is just
he talks about it every other episode,
and the pacing on that show was perfect.
The pace was perfect.
I mean, they couldn't have done it any better. I mean, I'm not one to go back and rewatch television shows right after they're finished, but after I finished the last episode, I went back and binged watched the whole season back over again just to go over it one more time to have as one big unit, and it was great.
And there aren't many shows these days. I think that probably Aaron's the same way. Like, there's not many shows that'll like pull the wool over our eyes and like surprise us. Like, I was legitimately like, when the reveal happens at the end of season one, I was like, what the actual?
Yep.
I get like the play on words and everything. It's so good. So good.
All right. And I will tell everybody, if you didn't know, Inspired by a True Story is back. That true crime podcast that we do where we take look at the true story behind movies. We start with The Conjuring. We're looking at the true story of Ed and Lorraine Warren and if they really did a damn thing with the Pierron family. Spoiler alert, they didn't.
They did nothing.
They did nothing. And then the next one is The Exorcism of Emily Rose, which is a great behind-the-scenes story. And not great. It's very interesting. It's a terrible story, but it's very interesting, and I think that's a really good episode. And it's already on Patreon if you're a Patreon subscriber, so... Thank you to those of you that listen on Patreon. Patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. That's going to do it for this episode. Rob, thank you for joining us, man. Appreciate it.
Always happy to lend my dulcet tones to your podcast.
Absolutely. Let me know how the revamp on the beer goes.
Will do.
Troy, as always, sir, tip the hat.
Pleasure to be here as well. And good to see Rob as well.
Eh. Aw, that's nice.
It's good to be seen.
See Amanda once in a while. Is she still doing these? I don't know.
Here, I thought we were going to get through one show without digging her way.
Oh, no. There's people that hate when I do it, so I'm going to do it because fuck that.
Because fuck the haters.
Yep, exactly. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Remember to share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group or on Twitter at BuyPopcorn, Facebook and Threads at The Hollywood Outsider, and our site is thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's going to do it. So remember, the next time you head to a theater or stream comfortably on your couch, buy popcorn.